Welcome to episode 4 of the Mitchell Institute Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, Lieutenant Colonel Retired John Slickbaum, and I'd like to begin this episode with a huge thank you to the early adopters of the Aerospace Advantage podcast. In short order, we have reached an audience across America, Asia, Europe, South America, and Australia with thousands of downloads of the first 3 episodes. The feedback has been great, and our team appreciates the words of support and suggestion of topics you'd like to learn more about. We've enjoyed explaining the current state of play when it comes to air and space power in the first few episodes, and now with that foundation, we can begin discussing how our team at Mitchell believes accelerated change will ensure the United States remains the premier air and space power. The threat environment is demanding new solutions. But here's the thing. We're trying to make these new goals with a limited budget and COVID-19 fiscal realities that are only going to make things tougher. So how do we get more for the dollars we are spending? It all comes down to a concept called cost per effect. The cost per effect way of thinking focuses on measuring what it costs to realize mission objectives, not just the individual pieces of mission hardware absent of context. However, I am here to tell you the analytic tools leaders in the Pentagon, Congress, and the broader defense community are using don't reflect this approach. Their way of thinking focuses too much on the upfront purchase price without considering its value. So, if you're looking to compare the virtues of a B-17 versus a B-24, two airplanes that are pretty similar, then the current calculus works great. However, if you want to understand how the F-35 stacks up against the F-15EX and where you should direct your next defense dollar, then you need a new approach. That's because the two jets reflect radically different operating realities, given that one incorporates fifth-generation technologies and the other doesn't. Technology matters. A handful of F-35s and B-21s can accomplish what would take dozens of lower-tech jets to accomplish and do it with far less risk. Upfront price doesn't account for that. This is a big deal, and unless we update our analytical tools, the military risks spending limited dollars on systems that don't give us the best value. To help discuss this, I've asked Doug Berkey, Mitchell Institute's Executive Director, to join us. Doug and Mitchell Dean, Lieutenant General Dave Deptula, dug into this last year with an in-depth report that helped shed some light on this problem.
Slick, thanks for having me on today. You're hitting the nail on the head. You know, many aircraft are supposedly expensive by traditional measures, and they're actually the most prudent investments the Department of Defense can make to get the job done and not break the bank. But to understand this demands context. So here's a way to think about it. Do you think a smartphone is expensive? Well, it's an empty question unless you baseline the price against the alternative. So, we know what life was like before smartphones. It involved lots of separate devices, a cell phone, a Walkman, a camcorder, an electronic organizer, an audio recording device, a computer hooked up to the internet, digital camera, television, radio, GPS, a newspaper subscription. You get the point here. It's a lot of stuff. So, if you want to put the cost of a smartphone in context, you need to add up all these older individual alternatives. And even then, the end product won't work as well. So buying all that stuff would also cost a lot more than the smartphone. You know, combat aircraft are the same way, except in combat, effectiveness often means the difference between life and death. So people say newer tech is costly without understanding what they're really, looking at and buying, and without considering the option of plan B. And that's because these folks focus too much on buying the things without much focus on what they're actually used for. And, it's easy to look at a spreadsheet, how much something costs up front or how much its cost per flying hour is. But if you do not look at how the missions are actually flown, you're missing it.
So, Doug, what are the technologies that yield a better value from a cost per effect vantage?
Well, Slick, the first answer depends on missions. So what I'd say for airlift is different than what I'd say for something like a bomber, for example. But if we were to look at combat Air Force missions, fighters and bombers predominantly here, the ability to survive without demanding tons of extra protection from escort aircraft is probably number one. And that's why things like stealth technology are important. They shrink the strike packages and reduce risk. And if you think about it, strike packages for non-stealthy types can be dozens of support aircraft just to keep them alive with fighter escort, jammers, SAM suppression, you name it. You think about buying all those individual tails, sustaining them, deploying them, all the people, that's a huge bill. So next, and this is related to the first, is fifth generation technology like the F-22, F-35, and B-21. They have an efficiency advantage because of their onboard sensors, the computing power, and the ability to team. And all this allows them to understand the battle space better, to be at the right time and place to get the job done in the smartest fashion possible and avoid high-risk zones. And then finally, it comes down to range and payload. Less refueling support is always a good thing, and more missiles and bombs on a plane means more tasks accomplished given a mission.
Doug, having spent a tour as a requirements officer, this all makes sense to me, because today's challenges demand a procurement strategy far different than simply going after the lowest bidder. Doug, when I think about it, I'd argue the drivers for the cost per effect analysis came out of Vietnam when aircraft stopped being simple gun and bombing platforms. Now, think about types like the F-4, the F-111, and A-6. The electronic guts inside began to matter so much more. This is really the birth of the weapon systems with a rise of computing power, sensors, and data links. They expand the power of an aircraft well beyond the aerodynamic design and the stick and rudder skills of the pilot.
Sick, I totally agree. This step forward wasn't cheap, which set off a debate that's still alive and well today, and two camps emerged. Those who believed in technology and those who fought for a more traditional, simpler approach. And I know we'll get to it later, but I would emphasize that the battles we see playing out today along these lines are nothing new. And it's really a philosophical debate. And I'd argue history has been pretty consistent regarding who is right here.
Sure. Well, when I think about the power of early weapon systems and the associated technologies, there's nothing more illustrative than the emergence of smart munitions that came out towards the end of the Vietnam War. For most of the war, air crews just struggled to get their bombs on target. The enemy didn't have big installations like factories, so it came down to striking smaller targets that were well defended. Now, consider this. The Air Force spent 7 years in an amazingly high number of sorties to take out the Dragon's Jaw Bridge. And we lost a ton of airmen and aircraft in the process, all for one bridge. Now, by today's standards, Doug, it's crazy. But let's look at the numbers. I did a little research here. In the first attempt in 1965, there were 46 F-105s with unguided bombs, 21 F-100s providing air cover, and two RF-101s for bomb damage photo reconnaissance, and 10 tankers to refuel the whole strike package. The results saw aircraft shot down, and the bridge was still standing. A repeat attempt the next day netted the same scorecard.
Yeah, Slick, that's a great example. And you know, over the next 7 years, aircrew flew over 800 sorties against that bridge, and it was still standing there. And we lost 11 more aircraft. And as you know, getting shot down in Vietnam was far from a pleasant experience.
And Doug, this is why technology is so important. In 1972, smart munitions with enough mass and precision to take out a bridge began to enter the fold, and they changed the game. 14 F-4s carrying laser-guided bombs dropped the bridge with no aircraft lost that spring. Now, some may have called the laser-guided bombs expensive, and in a per-unit cost perspective, they're right. A laser-guided bomb back in those days cost about $24,000 versus $3,000 for a dumb bomb. However, think about the broader operational picture. We've done the math, and here's how it breaks out. Given that 900 strike sorties were flown with dumb bombs, this equates to $7.1 million compared to the $1.3 million in smart weapons. Now, let's not forget about the $36 million in replacing the aircraft shot down. And of course, there's no price tag that adequately measures the loss of life or the fate of the air crews as POWs. So the bottom line is the advanced technology saved time, money, it brought down risk, and it netted the objectives. But what should worry us is that 50 years later is that most of the planning is still done using measures that would favor the unguided bomb approach because it appears cheaper on a spreadsheet. That's why folks are still railing about the B-2, F-22, and F-35 being supposedly expensive.
Yeah, Slick, given the challenges posed by China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, and others, we really have to get real about buying smart.
And Doug, that leads us to a guest I'm really excited to introduce. It's General John Jumper, the 17th Air Force Chief of Staff. And here's why I wanted him to join us today. His generation, the airmen coming out of Vietnam, are the ones that really helped fight for the technologies that would give us a cost per effect advantage for decades. They saw the problems in Vietnam, they saw their buddies getting shot down, and they knew the threat the Soviet Union was posing. They knew they had to change how the Air Force fought and flew if they were going to have a chance against some very, very tough odds. So with that, General, welcome to the show. Now, up to this point in this episode, we've walked our listeners through the importance of precision munitions towards the back end of Vietnam. And I'm just curious, would you mind to tell us the first time you saw a laser-guided bomb?
Sure, I'd be happy to. First, I want to say thanks to the Mitchell Institute and the Air Force Association for putting on this series. I think this is very important to keep our constituents informed about the degrees and the kinds of air power that are out there. So, but back to the question, I remember distinctly, I was a forward air controller, a fastback in an F-4 up in the fish's mouth of the Plaine des Jars in Laos. And we've been working on this gun sight for several hours, actually. And here, all of a sudden, showed up a group of a couple of F-4s that said they got laser-guided bombs. Well, we knew they'd been used in other parts of the theater, but we hadn't seen any yet. So, in short, they came in. There was one guy circling, aiming the laser at the target. The other guy dropped the bomb in the basket. One bomb later, the whole thing is gone. And at that moment, I said, we should never be dropping another dumb bomb again in the United States Air Force.
Wow, sir, that's an incredible experience. So when you saw that, really, what did that mean for how you were thinking about the future technology and all that? Did it just really kind of open up the aperture for where you thought things could go?
Well, yeah, and we saw it actually happen. After years and years of trying to drop the bridges with dumb bombs around Hanoi, we see the Air Force with 9 Pave knife pods, laser designators, go up there and in one mission drop a bridge, the next mission drop the next bridge. It was unbelievable. So for later on, when I get to go to Nellis as a weapons school instructor, we work hard on getting the terminal guidance flight formed in the weapons school, and we are the people who introduced the Pave spike pod into the field. And this was the next generation of laser designation with more stable laser point on the target and just better accuracy. So I was dedicated at that point to using that technology with all the leverage we could get, not only with laser, but with video guidance, visual guidance, imaging infrared, and the other things that were becoming available at the time.
So coming out of Vietnam there, you're part of a key generation that helped create the Air Force that developed and fielded some of the most successful aircraft and weapons of all time. What was the mindset back then? Because, you know, you guys had this notion of increasing effectiveness and efficiency and lethality versus a lot of cheap mass just to throw at it. So, you know, how did this equation formulate? And as I understand it, it was a heated debate at some point.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I'm a guy that's never been satisfied with the status quo. I'm not happy now with where we are. I've never been happy with where we are. Always looking for the next thing. But just think, it is interesting to think about how far we've come. Back in those days, you know, we were still living with people with leadership in the Air Force that worked the large strike packages in World War II. And that was the thinking. Mass was the name of the game, which is not bad, of course. But we were not effective with electronic warfare, with jamming, with sensors that actually accurately told us what the threat was. And then as time went on, that was further complicated when we ran up against, in our own red flag operations, against jamming, Russian jammers that in many cases rendered us ineffective. And this was before we had anti-jamming radars. You know, I'm out there as a captain in the weapons school inventing comm out turns so that we can maneuver a flight in the presence of comm jamming. This was a time where the technology couldn't arrive quickly enough to fill our needs. And at the same time, we're going through this. We have the, you may remember the defense mafia. This was Jim Fallows and Pierre Spray and many people in the Defense Department that are very smart people. I got to know Jim Fallows pretty well. He's a smart guy. But they were looking at strictly at budget-driven figures and numbers and not about effectiveness. This is the time where I like to say that we graduated from a doctrine of higher, faster, farther in the Air Force to a doctrine of stealth, standoff, and precision. And later on, I add a fourth, which is persistence, have become key features and necessities of air power. And this is where you graduate from fourth generation to fifth generation fighters in capability and to be able to be effective and to be able to do it in a way that doesn't cost excess lives, like we saw back in some of the mass drills where using mass led to large numbers in attrition and not very accurate target damage. So we have to be cognizant of where technology takes us, where to leverage it, And this graduation to Stealth Standoff Precision and Persistence, I think, superbly served the American people with their United States Air Force.
And, sir, talking about the notion of survivability here, I mean, the experience in Vietnam, we obviously saw some pretty major losses during periods of that war. I mean, we lost a number of B-52s there in Linebacker 2 and others. Obviously, you referenced Yom Kippur War, where, I mean, a lot of U.S. types, F-4s, A-4s, and others were lost in huge numbers. I mean, there had to be a point here, and I think it's what I'm hearing you say, where it wasn't even an option. We had to go towards stealth and other things. Otherwise, there was no way to have sustainable power projection.
Well, it was a huge fight back there, as you indicated earlier, with this defense mafia who, you may recall, the advent of the mud fighter. That was a serious proposition that was put forth back in those days, where we would take a derivative of the P-51 by thousands of them, or buy a derivative of the T-38 or the F-5 and buy thousands of them, and overcome any enemy with numbers. The original idea of the F-16 was just a gun and Sidewinder missiles and a fuzzbuster radar detector for an ECM suite. As we have seen, things have become so much more sophisticated that had we gone those routes, regardless of the number of people you'd have to train and the loss of life in a contest like we saw in Kosovo or in Desert Storm or Desert Shield, would have been unacceptable by any standard to the American people. I've always been a guy that says we ought to win the game 100-0, and that we shouldn't be buying the force that's going to win 51-49.
Sir, Desert Storm saw a high-tech Air Force neutralize the Iraqi military in just a few short days. How did the technology play into Desert Storm's success, and how do we keep innovating to stay ahead of our competitors?
Stealth was fundamental. Electronic warfare was fundamental to these changes during that period of time. And the integration of these systems with AWACS, Joint STARS, made things even better. But we never really got as good as we could get. I recall the program, you may remember the JAST program, which was a technology investment program, which of course led to the F-35. But the program's idea was that there would be a continual investment in fighter technology. That's the kind of thing we need in order to make these investments affordable over the long term, is a continuous investment, continuous technology improvement, upgrade what you've got as long as you can, be ready to make the change to new platforms when the threat calls for it.
Well, sir, one of the things that you got to see when you were commanding the air operations over Kosovo was the B-2 being put to the test for the first time. So like this new technology, what did the ability to launch missions from the United States have, you know, with this large global range, large payload, stealth and precision munitions bring to the campaign?
Well, it's funny because when we wanted to bring the B-2s into the fight, there was great resistance in Washington we really had to struggle through this. But the ability for us in that conflict to demonstrate taking off from Whiteman Air Force Base, flying a global ranges, working all the logistics of that with tankers and everything else, getting bombs on targets. And you may remember the first targets were runways, putting a string of bombs right down the center line of the runway and taking the runway completely out with a stealthy bomber that flew right into the teeth of the threat and returned home. That's what we bought the airplane for, and that's why I insisted, along with others, that we put it in the fight and show what it can do. And it did. It went into the teeth of the threat, and it did an amazing job. It wasn't only the B-2, it was the B-1 as well. You may recall the B-1 had just recently been modified with the latest electronic warfare set that they put on the airplane. And it came in and did a wonderful job. So it's putting this technology that we invested so much money in to work and demonstrate to the American people the leverage that it gives us. And that leverage continues today. We have maybe threats out there that do better against stealth, but they don't negate stealth. And it is just as important today as it has been in the past. And you combine that with other measures that give us this combination of stealth standoff, precision, and persistence, and that that is where we, that's the technology track we need to keep pursuing.
Sir, can you talk to us about the importance of information in aerospace conflict in the modern era? I think when we're transitioning from the industrial age to the information age, it's important that people really understand what this means.
Well, it's all over the place. If you look at the F-22 and the F-35, they're originally built so that their data links didn't really coordinate with one another. We treated these things like isolated platforms that couldn't be seen, touched, or heard by anybody but somebody with the most sacred clearances. And yet the battlefield is populated with weapon systems, B-1s, B-2s, F-22s, F-35s, tankers, and command and control aircraft and platforms that need information flowing all ways in order to take the maximum leverage out of from the platforms, which is why we bought them in the first place. I recall in Iraqi Freedom, as we ran up the road in 2003, the dust storm that covered everything up. And you may recall, we had the Global Hawk, we had the Joint Stars, the Rivet Joint, and between the three of them, the captains in the back of the airplanes got together on the chat nets and found the tanks, the Republican Guards that were coming south. And we used this combined information to really do damage to the Republican Guard units headed south. We gave each other high fives, we patted each other on the back. And I turned around, I thought about it a minute, and I said, you know, we did that on chat networks at the speed of typing. What if we could do that at the speed of light? And so you take the F-22 with its ability to penetrate and the F-35, you integrate it with the platforms that we have and the potential of space, if we're ever able to properly integrate that, and you think of the next leverage points that are available to us are absolutely amazing. These things all come together with the kind of leverage that we never thought possible before, and we still need to work to take full advantage of it. We're still not doing what we need to take full advantage of it.
Now, sir, during your tenure as chief, the F-22 gained operational capability, you know, which meant it was obviously cleared to fly actual missions. And you even flew the jet. I remember when that happened, and you had a big smile on your face whenever we'd ask you about that, which is pretty cool. But could you please talk to us? I mean, you're a guy that started out in F-4s, you went to F-16s, and then you flew the Raptor. Can you talk about what that technological curve did for the effectiveness of the Air Force and the efficiency?
Sure. You know, I was in on the F-22. I was a wing commander at Nellis when we did the cockpit evaluations and built the cockpits and the processes for the switchology and everything. It was a magnificent process to watch, and I think we did an excellent job of that. The best description I can give you of the difference is that, you know, in the F-4, all of the integration went on in the pea-sized brain of the fighter pilot, and in the F-22 and the F-35, it all goes on behind the dashboards. You're not looking at inputs. You're looking at already digested wisdom when it's presented to you on your screen. In the old F-4 days, you used to reach down on your left-hand side to turn the electronic warfare pod on, and a green light came on when you put the switch forward. All that meant was you put the switch forward. You had no idea if that pod was working or not. In the F-22, you're sitting there looking at an analysis of the targets that are around you 360 degrees, how much of a threat they are, and what you need to do about it. It's what we all dreamed of. And I will never forget going up against eight F-15s on my final missions in the airplane with Bam Bam Stapleton on my wing, the squadron commander, and watching all of this come together in ways that almost brought tears to your eyes. It's what we always wanted. And there it was right in front of us. You combine that with the ability to carry a bunch of small diameter bombs and stand off tens of miles to put those very accurately on a target. And you've got a combination that's well worth the investment. I wish we had invested in more of them, and we'd be taking advantage of this for many years. The fact that we don't have any more than we do means that when we do have to use them, it's going to be very limited how many sorties we can generate, how many airplanes we can keep in the air. When we pursue these programs, we have to buy them in economic quantities and in quantities that can make a bigger difference on the battlefield.
Well, sir, hearing your experience with Raptor, when you hear people criticize the F-22 and other fifth generation types as expensive, how do you answer them? And sir, looking into the future, what should the next generation of fighter look like? Right now, the Air Force is calling it the Next Generation Air Dominance, or NGAD.
Well, the expense of the airplane is, we can, with the sixth generation, I think we can deal with the expense much better than we have in the past. It's a matter of how I think we work this problem of what I call off-board integration, where we can take a platform with the capabilities of the F-22 and we can bring real-time targeting information, real-time threat information, updates to airspace conflicts and other issues. We can bring those into the cockpit from space and other places of origin without having to load the airplane up with that kind of internal capability all by itself. This, I think, is how we fully explore cyber and fully explore space going into the future. This is the kind of leverage I think we're going to have. When we think about fifth generation airplanes now, we think about inputs. We think about their composites, their stealth capabilities, their advanced engine technology, their tracking and their targeting suites, the agility of the airplane. All those things are important, but the sixth generation should be more about output. In total integration, the ability to penetrate, real-time engagement of information, swarm techniques, and more about compliance with the concept of operations than just an answer to requirements, if you know what I mean. The airplane is built to fit into a concept of operations that leverages all of the platforms that we have available to produce the effect and the result.
Well, sir, thank you so much for all of your insight today and, you know, the effort and sacrifice that you and your generation made to build the post-Vietnam Air Force is what allowed, I know for myself as an F-16 guy, to fly in a harm's way, knowing I'd be able to get the job done to get home safe. So I can't thank you enough for your leadership and all that you've done. And thank you so much for taking your time to be on our show today.
Thanks, sir.
I'm happy to do it. And thank you all for doing this.
To give us the current state of play, I'd like to bring in General Deptula, Mitchell's DNN next. Sir, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Lick.
Sir, of course, we always love speaking with you. And this is a big deal because you were the principal planner in Desert Storm, and you introduced an effects-based perspective that led to what some have called the most successful air campaign in history. So the big question here is, how did stealth and precision radically affect the notion of cost per effect?
Sure, Slick. Let me give you a couple thoughts on that. Advances in technology, and it wasn't just the advances in technology, but it was also those in conjunction with this effects-based approach to planning and execution, really allowed us to institute a new concept of operations that has been described as parallel warfare, which is essentially the simultaneous application of force across the totality of an enemy system. Now, while simultaneous attack has always been a desired element of offensive warfare, it never evolved into the parallel warfare demonstrated in Desert Storm for three reasons. First, the requirement for mass to compensate for a lack of precision weapons delivery. Second, the large number of resources required to suppress enemy air defenses. And third, the absence of a focus on effects rather than destruction to achieve control over an opponent. The first two challenges really required technological solutions, and they just simply weren't mature prior to the mid-80s. And those two solutions were stealth and precision. To provide some insight into the significance of those two elements combined, in the first 24 hours of Desert Storm, stealth, precision, and this effects-based planning approach allowed the targeting of 36 stealth aircraft armed with precision-guided munitions against more separate targets than the complete non-stealth, non-precision air and missile force launched from the entire complement of six aircraft carriers and all the other ships in the theater combined. To put a cap on this, looking in retrospect, the stealthy F-117 force flew less than 2% of the combat sorties, but struck over 40% of the fixed target base. Now, Let me give you one more very specific example. The leverage that stealth demonstrated in the first Gulf War is fully illustrated by this particular attack. It was the first non-stealthy attack on one target in the Basra area, Shaiba Airfield to be exact. The attack package consisted of four US Navy A-6s dropping bombs, along with four Saudi Tornado bomb droppers, five Marine EA-6Bs jamming acquisition radars, four Air Force F-4Gs taking out one type of surface-to-air missile system, 17 Navy F-18s taking out other SAM systems, and then four F-18 escorts in case there were MiGs that showed up, and then three drones that caused the enemy radars to radiate. If you do the math, that's a total of 41 aircraft, eight of them dropping bombs on one target. Now, at the same time, about the same time, I had 20 F-117s all dropping bombs on 28 separate targets. So that's less than half the aircraft hitting 28 times the number of targets. So stealth, while expensive on a per unit aircraft basis, is at least an order of magnitude less expensive when considering cost per desired effect. And a matter of fact, in this example, it would have taken 19 non-stealthy aircraft to achieve the same effect as one stealth aircraft. That's what cost per effect is all about.
Now, sir, given that dramatic example, what was the state of play when you got back to Washington, finishing up your tour in the Pentagon, working in the Secretary of the Air Force's policy shop? Were people learning the lessons of Desert Storm and applying them?
At a macro level, each of the services were trying to highlight their achievements and contributions to Desert Storm, and each took away lessons. But the dissolution of the Soviet Union drove hope for a peaceful path forward with Russia. And that, in turn, led to a significant drawdown in U.S. defense spending. The so-called peace dividend, a lower defense spending, was easier to comprehend than the more complex concept of cost effectiveness, or getting the most value out of defense spending through cost per effect reasoning. A case in point is a reduction in the B-2 buy from 132 to 75 to 21 B-2s that were finally procured. Now, the rationale for the reductions was the high unit cost and the elimination of the Soviet nuclear threat. The focuses of the time, without consideration of the utility of the aircraft in the future. The conventional leverage of the B-2 simply was not recognized at that time frame. In fact, one B-2 could accomplish would have taken 75 combat aircraft during Desert Storm and at a fraction of the cost, even including procurement and sustainment cost. Now, a decade later, a similar rationale resulted in the termination of the F-22 buy at less than half its military requirement. The counterinsurgency fights of Iraq and Afghanistan were the focus of the day, and the Secretary of Defense at the time, Bob Gates, felt that since the F-22 wasn't needed for the counterinsurgency focus, production could be stopped. Again, excess focus on the present and seeking economy in expenditures to the exclusion of the future, and the failure to understand value in terms of cost per effect led to the geriatric Air Force that we have today, the oldest and the smallest in Air Force history.
Sir, where do we stand today? What scorecard do you use to measure where the bureaucracy is on this?
Well, unfortunately, Slick, the F-15EX being forced on the Air Force by cost-focused analysts in the Pentagon is evidence that combat effectiveness is less of a consideration in acquisition decisions than simple budget accounting. I hate to be that blunt, but that's the fact of the matter. The Pentagon is still stuck in World War II think. This is just going to get worse as we pursue concepts like mosaic warfare, joint all-domain command and control, and others, where the types of technologies we're going to buy will radically alter how we fight. These concepts will involve a mix of high-end assets like the B-21, while also incorporating smaller, simple systems that team. Think about concepts like loyal wingmen that pair low-cost drones with F-22s and F-35s. We've got to change, or the math will lead us to buy the wrong systems, because to an accountant or DoD leader who only has business experience, the only thing that matters to them is cost. We've got to put effectiveness back into the cost-effectiveness equation when determining what systems yield the Department of Defense its best value.
Now, sir, that really resonates, but there've got to be some bright spots here amongst all the challenges we face. What positive indicators do you see?
Well, some people do get this on an individual level. If you talk to Dr. Bill LaPlante, the former head of Air Force Acquisition, this is the kind of thinking that shaped B-21 procurement to a degree, and the decision to double down on fifth generation technology in our next long range strike bomber. And there's other folks that get it. The 2021 National Defense Authorization Act language is also encouraging, as it specifically directs the Pentagon to look into cost per effect assessment as a measure of merit in making procurement decisions. But all that said, more still needs to be done. And hopefully people listening to this podcast will take away some of these lessons and we'll be able to move forward in this regard.
Thanks, General Deptula and Doug. I really appreciate you being here to chat about all of this. For those of you who are still not sold, let me open the aperture a bit. Remember that smartphone versus the old federated way we used to manage technology example? Let me throw a comparative air power example your way in the same vein. Back in World War II, tons of resources were needed to hit a single target during the Allied bombing campaign in Europe, because at the time we lacked precision strike technology and we faced the lethality of Germany's air defenses. So let's consider a mission that was flown on January 28, 1944, when 863 8th Air Force B-17s and B-24s launched from England and dropped over 1,800 tons of bombs against a target in Frankfurt. 29 bombers failed to return from the mission, and an additional 135 were hit by enemy fire. And of those, 5 were so damaged that they never flew again. 353 airmen were listed as either killed, wounded, or captured. Added to this, 632 fighters flew as part of the strike package, and of these, 15 were shot down. Only 20% of the bombs struck within 1,000 feet of the target, so the amount of waste was huge. Now compare that to a one-hour period in the opening night of Desert Storm, when 20 F-117s hit 28 separate targets. So let's look at the business cases. And it's no surprise, we all know the B-17 and B-24 win on a unit cost comparison versus the F-117 hands down. With a normalized cost for 2021 dollars, the F-117 at a unit cost of $50 million was dramatically more expensive than the B-17 with a unit cost of just over $3 million. However, you can't forget that it took 863 World War II bombers to take out that one target, while 20 F-117s were used to strike 28 separate targets, and they did it in just a single hour. So using a simple cost per effect model, it costs roughly $36 million for an F-117 to strike a target, which is far less than the $292 million per target for the World War II bombers. And the World War II figure wholly ignores the cost of the fighter escorts, the fact that each World War II bomber was crewed by 10 airmen versus a single pilot in the 117, plus the relative cost of spare parts, fuel, logistics support, and basing infrastructure. More importantly, the comparison does not consider the human toll of airmen killed, wounded, and captured. Now, I get this. This comparison is between two very different technological eras. However, this exact example is happening. Look at how people are comparing the F-15EX to the F-35 as if they're the same class. It's absurd because they're talking about two different generations of aircraft. The EX is not stealthy, and it would take 10 to 20 of them to hit a defended target, given the need for mutual support and expected loss factors versus a handful of F-35s to do the same job. This isn't theoretical. We see this all the time in exercises today. This is also why we need to appreciate the value that range, payload, and survivability of the B-2 and B-21 give us. We also need to begin calculating how operating concepts like JADC2 and ABMS will change warfare through a far more distributed model. If we just focus on the sticker price, which is what happens far too often today, it's clear that people don't consider the effectiveness part of the cost-effectiveness equation. The challenges of the future are going to be much more difficult. It's also obvious that the economic distress caused by COVID-19 is going to shrink the resource pool for defense big time. Our national security commitments are not going anywhere. In fact, they're getting harder. That means we've got to be more careful than ever of getting the most out of every defense dollar spent. We must be responsive on how changes in technology are changing the types of questions we must ask to better acquire what it will take to win tomorrow's wars. It's also crucial to understand the operational world and let that drive the discussion, not just what fits nicely on a spreadsheet and can be easily calculated in the Pentagon. To put it simply, we need to prioritize what the warfighter needs to succeed relative to the resources allocated to the DoD, not simply by the largest number of units and what might appear to be the same category of capability. In other words, the DoD needs to shift its measure of merit from the lowest unit cost to cost per desired effect. With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to General Jumper, General Deptula, and Doug Berkey for today's discussion. And of course, to you, our listeners, for tuning in to today's episode of The Aerospace Advantage. In the next episode of The Aerospace Advantage podcast, we will commemorate the 30-year anniversary of Desert Storm and talk to the key leaders that made crucial decisions on night one of the war. If you like what you've heard today, please like, subscribe, and follow. And as always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn, or by visiting us on mitchellaerospacepower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum signing off. Fly safe and check six.